From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the remote viewing of Dr. Doom. Ed Dames returns. We're going to put his feet to the fire on a couple of those remote viewing episodes. Here's what's happening. A coronal mass ejection hit Earth's magnetic field on October 5th, sparking some minor geomagnetic storms around both poles. Who watches it but our expert Mitch Batros from EarthChangesMedia.com? Well, not a big one, Mitch, but let me ask you something. Can these geomagnetic storms affect people mentally?
Absolutely. There's scientific evidence that directly corresponds to that. In fact, they use geomagnetic pulse. One's called transcranial magnetic stimulation, where it's literally kind of like an EEG that's put on the head, kind of like with those suction cups or where they can pick up the signals. It's almost like a little helmet. And what it's used for is for emotional issues, depression, compulsivity, many things like under the DSM-4, it would be a type of panic attacks. All emotions. So there's a direct correlation. Do magnetic charged particles affect humans? Yes. Now, for some, they tell me that it's kind of like the earthquake people. They feel it somewhere in their body.
Well, what I'm beginning to see, Mitch, is during these ejections, you know, when they finally hit the planet in some form or fashion, I'm seeing people kind of whacked out, and I'm wondering if the two are related.
I am absolutely convinced, George, and I have put a lot of study and effort into that. I mean, mostly I talk about the earth-changing events, which I call external.
Sure.
But the internal changes kind of mirror the external changes. So we have these pulses or waves of earthquakes and volcanoes, these upsets, if you will, these cyclical events. A very similar thing happens within a person, and the source is the same, the charged particles.
What's new at earthchangesmedia.com, Mitch?
Well, following your lead, that the CME that we experienced, it's just like you said, George. You were correct. You hit it on in our show a few days ago. They are coming in as waves. So not only did we have a CME from one solar event, it was two. And the one on October 1st/2nd was really large. And then there was another one on October 3rd. Both of those have just hit. And it spiked the KP index to 5. And there's more coming. So we're going to have these continuous waves of CMEs. Remember, for the audience, it takes about 48 to 72 hours for the solar event that we witness on the sun to hit the Earth.
That's right.
And that depends on the potency of the solar event itself, on how fast it gets here.
Absolutely. Mitch, thank you so much. Yeah, some people think that because it's from the sun, they're going to travel at the speed of light. That's not the case. It takes about 3 days once it ejects from the sun. American militants like Anwar al-Awlaki are placed on a kill or capture list by a secretive panel of senior government officials, which then informs the president of its decisions. Now, there is no public record of the operations or decisions of the panel, which is a subset of the White House's National Security Council. Neither is there any law establishing its existence or setting out the rules by which it is supposed to operate. Doug Hagman, who monitors terrorist websites. Doug, this is a dangerous precedent. This panel, this group of secret people who can put anybody on a kill list.
Oh, this is an extremely dangerous precedent. And you know something, George, I don't believe that we are bearing witness to a legitimate a tool or methodology to facilitate our handling on the so-called war against terror. But what I see taking place right now is a very deliberate and a very sinister system of acclimation of the subjugation of our Constitution, the erosion of our civil liberties and civil rights. And this, we've seen this system of acclimation happen at the airport. First, it was the magnetometers, and then you take your belt off, and then all of a sudden your shoes, and then it increasingly became more and more and more invasive. And I think right now what we're seeing, and those people who have laughed to this point, and I consider myself one of them 10 years ago, 5 years ago even, that there is an oligarchy or a shadow government in place that right now is acting as a modern-day equivalent of a turbocharged star chamber. I mean, I see no other explanation for this.
What happens one day if a Doug Hagman or a George Norrie steps on somebody's toes and they're on the panel?
We may already be on that list or on a list. And indeed, you know, the chilling part of the press release or the release that I did see was the panel of principals could have, and I'm quoting now, could have different memberships when considering different operational issues. So one might, one must ask, what kind of operational, other operational issues might there be? And then we enter into this very dangerous sliding scale theory that anything could go on that list, including your beliefs, for example, of the Federal Reserve.
Well, just when I thought I heard everything, Doug, I've heard something else with this. Amazing. Thank you, Doug Hagman. Federal prosecutors have launched a crackdown on pot dispensaries in California, warning the stores that they must shut down in 45 days or face criminal charges and confiscation of their property, even if they are operating legally under the state's 15-year-old medical marijuana law. In an escalation of an ongoing conflict between the U.S. government and the nation's growing medical marijuana industry, California's four U.S. attorneys sent letters notifying at least 16 pot shops or their landlords that they are violating federal drug laws, even though medical marijuana is legal in California. An unbelievable story out of Ohio. In one of the most disturbing acts by an individual high school athlete in recent times, an Ohio football player placed a sharp object believed to be tacks in his glove before walking through a post-game handshake line. You know, when the game's over and they're all sports, you're right, they all line up and they slap their hands. He put tacks in his glove. He wasn't allowed to play, so he was on the sidelines. His team won. But as he's walking down the line, he's pricking the hands of the 27 opponents on the other team as he walked through and congratulated them on a game well played. They started bleeding. Every one of those 27 opponents had to get tetanus shots because of this guy. Unbelievable. The whole thing's under investigation. Well, with his granite jaw, toothy grin, and steely stare, they were tools that made Charles Napier one of the most recognizable actors in movie and television. He is dead at the age of 75. From the dim-witted country music star that John Belushi's flim-flammed in the House of Blue, the Blues Brothers, to the scheming military intelligence officer who matched wits with Sylvester Stallone in Rambo, First Blood 2, Napier appeared in scores of films and TV shows in a career spanning more than 40 years. He died Wednesday at the age of 75. He had collapsed the day before. In Shades of Weekend with Bernie, one of two men accused of driving around with their friend's corpse in the back seat thought the dead man was just drunk. Robert Young said he wanted to believe that Jeffrey Jarrett had simply passed out. While the two guys visited bars and a strip club and withdrew cash using the dead man's card before reporting his death, they now face charges including identity theft and abuse of a corpse. Man, I hear it all. A United Kingdom man who spent 12 years learning how to speak Klingon says it's helped him with his dyslexia. Jonathan Brown is now the chief linguist on a CD teaching others how to master the alien language from Star Trek. Now, the father of two had always been a fan of Star Trek, and his interest in Klingon began after discovering that there was a dictionary devoted to the language. He used that kind of language, and it helped him. He always had trouble reading, but he says he experienced no such troubles with reading Klingon, and he used it a different part of his brain, apparently. Amazing story. Out of Russia, most videos of an alleged Bigfoot tend to be out of focus, barely show the creature, but due to increased sightings, scientists from Canada and other countries have now been invited to Russia to hunt for Bigfoot, Sightings are up threefold over the past 20 years in a region of Siberia, and one Russian scientist estimates that there are dozens and dozens of Yetis living in an area about 3,000 kilometers east of Moscow. At least 15 people in Russia say they have spotted one in the past year, so we'll continue to follow up on that story. And, you know, there are many examples of technology and beliefs appearing decades, even centuries, before they supposedly happen. The Apollo program was apparently outlined a century before it happened. A painting from the Middle East in the Middle Ages show a flying toy helicopter. We found ancient Greek computers and heard stories of Roman death rays. The Pacific front of World War II was described 16 years before the war started. Up next, we're going to be talking with Out of Place in Space and Time with Lamont Wood on Coast to Coast AM. What a great book, Out of Place in Time and Space by Lamont Wood. Lamont is a freelance writer for nearly three decades, largely covering high-tech industries. He has sold more than 500 articles to various magazines, ranging from Scientific American to trade journals in Hong Kong, and has written more than eight books. He's a history buff as well, and he's written for history magazines. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Lamont, great job here. Really enjoyed
it. I'm glad you like it.
How did you do the research to get these stories behind
it? Well, I'm always a history buff, and basically I just kept a sort of a mental list of odd historical oddities as I went along, and I'm now older than I care to admit, and so I accumulated quite a few of them. I just sat down one day and started listing them and then fleshing them out and then looking for more. And the result we went down the slippery slope, and now we have this book in front of you here. It kind of wrote itself, really. And I'm a professional writer. I have a literary agent, and he seemed to understand exactly what I was doing before I did. But, you know, maybe that's the way it's supposed to work. And he got a publisher, and the publisher loved it. And the readers seem to be liking it, too. Again, it's a question of historical oddities that seem to fly in the face of a purely linear conception of history. And if you want to say it calls into question the nature of time and all that stuff, well, we can get into that too, but
okay.
Let me talk about it, because it does, frankly. But let's talk about it. It can be read just as an entertaining collection of historical oddities. I think there's 40 or 42 in there. You'd think I'd know the exact number by now. But the best example of what the book is about would be the example I start out with. The so-called Virgin and Child of Toy Helicopter. It's a church painting that's been hanging on the wall of a museum in France for, who knows, centuries now. And no one paid much attention to what, part of the composition has the Christ child sitting in the lap of the Madonna. Again, a fairly conventional church picture. And for centuries, probably no one paid much attention to what the Christ child is depicted as doing. However, in the last few decades, it kind of leaps out at us because the Christ child is depicted as playing with a pull-string toy helicopter.
He surely is. There's no question about it.
Yeah, and that's pretty weird considering it was painted in 1460. and if you want an explanation for that, I do have one. But
And I used to have one of those things, by the way. Pull a string, and the little whirly helicopter thing would go flying away.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Serious attempts to build an actual helicopter flying machine didn't start for, you know, several centuries after this. People point out to me that, you know, Leonardo da Vinci sketched out the idea of a helicopter, but he was like 8 years old when this thing was painted. I can only assume that the artist included this probably for two reasons. One, to introduce a cross motif, because, of course, there's four blades in a helicopter. Two, to show that this is an actual child we're dealing with, because the artistic conventions were such that, you know, children are just, you know, miniature adults in pictures. But there must have been an assumption that anyone looking at it would say, oh, it's a toy. You know, that must have been
a creative toy from the 1400s.
Yeah, it must have been a fairly common toy at that point in fairly wide circulation. Anyone would look at it. And I assume it evolved from, you know, whirligigs, you know, which we rotating thing that you on the end of a stick that you wave and it turns and makes noises and flashes colors, and if you take it off the stick and spin it, you know, you get it flies, and that's probably where it came from. But in the final analysis, we have a flying machine used as a child's toy centuries before anyone paid any serious attention.
Yeah,
just having a flying machine. And that's, oddly enough, sort of a theme I kept running across researching this book, the fact that the children's toys are often apparently considered too frivolous for serious study. I also ran across the fact that the Greeks and Romans had steam-powered toys, for instance, yet they made no real attempt to use them for to do real work.
And you think they would.
Yeah, you think they would. But
make a bigger one, you know?
Yeah, make a bigger one, you know, tie it up to something, tie it up to a pump or something, and go. But as far as we can tell, that never happened. It was seen as a toy. And we've all heard of these, it's not in the book, we've all heard of these accounts of wheeled toys being found in tombs in Central America in cultures that did not themselves use wheeled transport. Although that's probably because they didn't have, you know, good roads and trapped animals.
That's
stuff.
Right.
It was no real advantage. So, so I think the lesson here is, you know, what are the kids playing with that we should be paying attention to? I mean,
on your cover of your book, Out of Place in Time and Space, mm-hmm. you've got what looks like the Virgin Mary praying,
right,
with a UFO,
right,
you know, hovering over her shoulder. Uh-huh. Now,
right.
Either the artist was extremely creative,
uh-huh,
or there's something in the background that he saw,
right,
when he did this.
Okay, yeah, I have a whole chapter on these things. It turns out that there are a number of medieval and Renaissance church paintings that appear to have in them what we would call flying saucers. And I admit that they do look like flying saucers.
I mean, they're clearly,
yeah,
they're clearly objects like in the sky.
Yeah, they're clearly an object in the sky. So, but then we have to step back and realize that what we're doing is taking our visual vocabulary and imposing it on people who had their own visual vocabulary. And they don't really mean the same thing. Throughout the book, I stick with Occam's razor, which, of course, is from William of Occam, the medieval philosopher, and said that the simplest explanation is the one to go with, all other things being equal. And I think the simplest explanation here is that, basically, this is a very expensive illustration of a biblical story, and that is what they're doing. They're trying to illustrate the story of the nativity. And that includes, in the Bible, mention of shepherds in the fields by night being confronted with the heavenly host and reacting to them. And if you do look at that picture, you notice a guy there on the ground, and he has some sheep around him, and he's reacting to this thing in the sky. So apparently they're trying to depict the divine presence or something, and they end up with some kind of hole in the sky, basically, with golden rays coming out of it. And I believe that it was made fashionable by Dante in his Divine Comedy when he describes the divine presence as being at the base of a vortex of angels. And you send a vortex down to Earth, and it makes a hole in the sky,
yeah,
because they assumed that there was a crystal sphere out there among what the stars are attached to. I really think that's what we're looking at here.
It's truly amazing. And then, yeah, then the photo of obviously somebody in a single person flying craft.
Oh, yeah, that's even better.
I mean, my God.
That's even more complicated. You see, that's from a monastery in Kosovo. It's painted in about 1350, and it's part of a crucifixion scene. And it does look like rather crude rendition or some unlettered artist trying to show a mercury capsule, really, because of the way the shape it is, you know, and it comes to a teardrop and there's one person inside of it. And I would point out that people started referring to this as a UFO in the 60s when, of course, the Mercury program was in all the newspapers. But, you see, this is part of the Byzantine tradition of depicting the crucifixion.
It's always pretty high-tech to me.
It looks pretty high-tech, but let me point out, and you can find dozens of examples of these. There'll usually be, to one side of the cross, something in the sky that's red and has a male face, and on the other side there'll be something that's silver and has a female face.
Mm-hmm.
The red one is the sun, the silver one is the moon, and you'll see the red one will be moving toward the cross, and the silver one will be moving away from the cross. And this is to reflect the fact that the Gospels say that on the day of the crucifixion, it was dark from noon to 3 p.m.
We're going to come back and talk more with you about Out of Place in Time and Space. Lamont Wood, our guest this hour on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, remote viewer Major Ed Dames joins us. He's going to try to scare the bejeebies out of us, so we'll chat with him about that. Hey, we are down now just to 800 people this month for joining the Coast Insiders Club. That's all you have to do. If you can dabble around with the 25 cents, a little less than that a day, you can become a Coast Insider. Downloads, chats, and all the other things that go with it. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com and look for the Coast Insider icon right there at the top of the homepage. When we come back, more stories with Lamont Wood and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, where with Lamont Wood, we're talking about his work, Out of Place in Time and Space. The picture we were talking about with the little Christ child with the top, with the little whirly bird thing on the top, is part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Lamont, let's get back to the story about the little spaceship that you have on the cover of your book.
Okay, yeah. Again, that's one of a number of medieval and Renaissance church paintings that I include in the book that appear to show flying saucers in the sky. And you can certainly believe that. I put forth other explanations because, again, I try to stick to Occam's razor. But that doesn't mean that I'm right, frankly. and in some cases, really, you have to realize that we're in great danger of imposing our visual vocabulary on people who had their own, had a rather rich visual vocabulary, and rather separate from ours, really. But you can pretty much be sure that anything in these paintings was there on purpose. It's not there by accident. It's not there for personal expression by the artist, because he wanted to get paid. And if they're showing something in the sky, I think there's some committee that decided that would be a good idea. Now, I really think that if the medieval church had wanted to show flying saucers, they would have done so. And maybe they did. I don't know. But the title of the paintings indicates that they are about biblical stories.
It's weird stuff, though, I'll tell you.
It's weird stuff, yeah. And it does leap out at you. And I think and maybe there is some, you know, something, I don't know, some basic urge to put things in the sky and make them round. I don't know. I think this needs greater discussion than it's received, basically.
One of those praising your book, by the way, Bob Curran, Dr. Bob Curran, is going to be our guest tomorrow night on Coast to Coast for a little bit.
Okay. But a lot of things in this book need further examination, I believe. And some of these things, like calling the question, you know, maybe the space-time continuum is a little fuzzy around the edges or something.
Tell me about your thoughts in the book about the moons of Mars being artificial.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I try to stick to Occam's razor throughout, which is the simplest explanation is the best. And generally, that leads away from paranormal explanations, except when I get to the moons of Mars, and I find myself painted into a corner by it, because you look at their characteristics, and there's a laundry list of things about them that are natural. They are almost perfectly circular orbits. The orbits do not match the plane of the ecliptic, where most of the planets are. They match instead the Martian equator. They could not have been formed of Mars. They presumably are captured asteroids. But Mars is not really equipped to catch incoming asteroids. For that, you need like a retinue of other moons to slow down the incoming object, or a thick atmosphere. And Mars doesn't have that thick atmosphere. For moons, it just has those two moons. What, do they capture each other? I don't think so. So if they're not artificial moons, they ought to be, basically. And also, they'd be very convenient for someone involved in planetary navigation for space travel, because with them in low orbit like that, you could put facilities on them to extract fuel, especially oxygen,
sure,
from the rocks, from the chemicals on those that make up the rocks. And then after you get into orbit, you could go there and refuel, which is a lot more convenient than what NASA is faced with, where you have to bring it all with you on the first launch. Presumably, there are two of them. Probably the lower one, Phobos, is for outbound traffic. The higher one, Deimos, would be for inbound traffic. I'm presuming all this.
That's a pretty good assumption, though.
Yeah. So, so who put them there, and when, and why? You know, we're pretty sure that no one. There's been no civilization on Mars recently. We have the place is pretty heavily explored by this time. The theory I throw out, which is purely for entertainment, is that they've probably been there for tens of millions of years. And if you go back to Earth, the surface of the planet was pretty much reformed, and most of the larger life forms were wiped out, with the Chicxulub impact about 65 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs. Now, that was from the impact of an object about the size of Phobos, which makes you wonder, maybe they tried the same thing here. And
well,
flipped up.
Some have said that.
Yes, and
as far-fetched as it may be, some have said.
But you know, it all fits together. You know, and like I said, I paint myself no corner here with my rationalism. One of the species of dinosaurs that was wiped out was called Struthiomimus, which stood upright and had grasping forelimbs and stereoscopic vision.
How tall was it?
About man-sized.
Okay.
And we stand upright and have grasping forelimbs.
Almost like a raptor.
Yeah, a raptor with hands, basically.
Yeah.
Now, if one of those, if it had a setup species that had some extra brain capacity and pressed on to some kind of technological mastery, we know that only takes a few centuries in our case. And maybe they did that. Maybe they're responsible for all this, and there's no trace of them after the impact, basically. They went out with such a bang. I'm not sure what we would find after that impact and after these millions of years, except maybe the remains of what they left in orbit around Mars. Now, let's go back to that. On Phobos, they have found what they call a monolith in one of the space probe photos. And it looks to me like the top of a silo sticking out of the dust.
Really?
Yeah, the resolution isn't really that good to say much else. Except that or a very symmetrical rock sticking out of the ground.
Which is possible.
Yeah, which is possible.
Possible.
And other analysis shows that Phobos is about 30% hollow. But maybe that means it's just loosely packed rock. But it all, you know, you could see it, you know, spelling some other situation too, some other scenario. Maybe it is an artificial, it's put place artificially, and then there's tunnels in it, and the remains of industrial facilities from millions of years ago. I mean, by now the surface has been bombarded with so much space debris. It's, if it had started out looking, you know, new and shiny, but now it looks like, you know, an old charcoal briquette, basically. And you would expect that. So I've reached a point where I no longer think that space exploration is a luxury. You know, I really think that we live in the solar system, too, and we better understand it very thoroughly because there's stuff going on out there. Because then I talk about Iapetus, which is even weirder than the two moons of Mars.
It's got that strange riff to it, too.
Yes, it looks like a walnut.
Yeah.
Which is very odd. It's the only, it's the only moon in the solar system that seems, that is like two-toned. When it first found, the astronomers thought it was like appearing, disappearing. And they assumed that it had a light in the dark side when they couldn't see it when the dark side was pointed toward us. And when they got better telescopes, they discovered that was actually the case. But again, that's the only moon in the solar system that does that. Now, 2001, A Space Odyssey, was based on a novel that was inspired by that phenomena.
That's
of
right.
The Iapetus, assuming that it was some kind of signal, you know, flashing on and off slowly. Okay, now space probes did get to it from the last few years. And there is a dark side to it, and it looks like, a big bag of soot or something exploded over the surface, made this big splotch there. Now, inside the splotch, there is what looks like a wall extending from one end of the dark splotch to the other, following almost exactly along the moon's equator. And, close up, you can see it's an eroded mountain range. From a distance, it looks like the seam of a walnut. Or maybe a badly made ping pong ball, something like that. Now, if you want to say ET did that, fine. Why? What rational explanation would there be for this? I mean, even as a natural event, again, it just seems to be very hard to explain this. So, again, I think we need to get to the bottom of what's going on.
We live
in the solar system. You know, there's stuff going on out there.
Let's take a call from Mankato, Minnesota. Jack, go ahead. You're on with us.
Hi, George. Hi, Lamont. How are you this evening?
Good.
Okay, yes.
You know, what an interesting subject, Lamont. And I have to tell you something. I'm an old fart like you and George.
Oh, dear.
And when I was very young, I saw a movie called Chariots of the Gods.
Yeah.
And it explored cave drawings and various other things that indicated that things just could not have possibly been done without some type of aerial affiliation. I mean, the roads that went nowhere, that until you get above them, they outline spiders.
Mm-hmm.
And cave drawings of rocket ships and helicopters, and people had bubbles over their head.
See, I'm convinced that those people of that era saw things and they just depicted them on caves and paintings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced of it. Tell me about Archimedes and his death ray.
Okay, Archimedes gets three chapters in the book. I mean, when you talk about historical oddities and things that are grossly out of place, he keeps showing up. He was like the mad scientist of the ancient world. And he was apparently in charge of defense planning for the city-state of Syracuse, which is on the eastern shore of Sicily. And during the big war between Rome and Carthage, there was a coup d'etat, and they defected from the Roman side to the Carthage side, and the Romans sent an army to retake the place. There are like three ancient historians that describe what happened next, and it reads like science fiction, but it's been sitting on the bookshelves for 22 centuries now. They attacked in daylight and found themselves being hit by missile fire that tracked them wherever they went, even to the base of the walls, indirect. They didn't think that was possible, but it implies finely tuned catapults, accurate range finders, and central fire control. You don't see that until about 1912 in the modern era. Now, they came back at night with a naval attack against the seawall, where it faced deep water, and they were going to scale directly over the walls from their ships, and they brought their ships up to the walls. And they said at that point, large machines reared up on the other side of the wall, reached out, and capsized their ships or just smashed them. And, of course, they panicked and ran away. Apparently, he had built something that resembles modern construction cranes. We have the upright and the horizontal boom, presumably using naval equipment. Okay, and then we have other sources that talk about the death rays he then used to defeat the Roman Navy.
Yeah.
Presumably, these were billboard-sized arrays of polished metal mirrors that he would reflect the sunlight at enemy ships, which, of course, were made out of wood. Now, modern efforts to replicate this have had mixed results, and you can't really get a whole ship that's popping the flames, especially, you know, when they have sailors aboard with buckets and wet canvas and all that stuff, although you can get some effect. But when I was writing this, I happened to watch celebrity puff news channels, and they were talking about some movie star having a birthday party and a resort in Baja California, and she was being bothered by all these paparazzi bobbing out there in the surf. So the management of the resort lined up people along the shore with mirrors and reflected the sunlight into the faces and cameras of the paparazzi and drove them away. Now, but what if the stakes were higher? You know, what if people were killing each other? Well, you might be still a cheap way to drive people away, you know, to drive away the enemy boats. And also, you probably would like your blockade runners to go in and out during daylight, and this way you could, like, blind the enemy picket boats and guard boats, et cetera. So setting fire to the enemy vessels may, in fact, have been not the main idea, although probably would have been welcomed if it did happen.
See, I'm convinced, Lamont, that there was high technology a long time ago. Civilizations are much older than we think.
Mm-hmm.
And whether they got extraterrestrial help or not, this planet had high technology a long time ago. You've got pictures of what looked like, you know, metallic gears and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. Let's go east of the Rockies. Paul, truck driving in Missouri. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, long time listener since Art Bell.
Well, thank you, sir.
You bet. Not a problem. Your guest talked about the artificial moons are probably artificial moons at Mars. Do you think they might be space stations?
I assume that they are asteroids. Well, this is the theory anyway, that were maneuvered there. They are actual natural asteroids. They're not artificial. They're not sheet metal construction. That were maneuvered there using rocket fuel, probably made out of the minerals of the rocks themselves on that asteroid, and put into orbit around Mars to facilitate space travel, because then you could go on and continue mining the rocks for rocket fuel. And again, that would be a lot more convenient than taking it all with you. You would take off from Mars and go into orbit and dock with one of these asteroids and refill, basically. And the asteroids themselves have minimal gravity, so escaping from them is no big deal.
Well, where do you get your book, Out of Place in Time and Space?
In better bookstores, basically.
Are there any left?
As far as I know, yeah. Certainly Amazon does have it also. So you can just look for it there. Again, the title is Out of Place in Time and Space by Lamont Wood, L-A-M-O-N-T-W-O-O-D.
Lamont, of everything you looked at when you put this book together, which one baffled you the most? What story?
Probably, well, some of them are very baffling, but the one I like most, as far as baffling goes, would be Jules Verne's first novel. He, of course, is known as a science fiction writer.
And he was great.
Yeah, and he wrote a number of novels that included technological predictions. Most of these predictions, though, were extrapolations of stuff that existed in his lifetime, such as, you know, fax machines and air conditioners, whatever. But his first novel, written in 1865, describes an American effort to send three men to the moon in an aluminum capsule launched from Florida. They circle the moon. They return to Earth. They land in the Pacific Ocean and are picked up by the U.S. Navy. Now, does that sound familiar?
It sure
now,
does.
That is beyond coincidence. In fact, he includes a fairly detailed budget for this project, and its modern analysis shows that like 85% of what the Apollo program actually did cost at the time of the Apollo 8 mission, which is what he's apparently describing.
And with those dollars, too, that's pretty good.
Yeah, well, you know, you include inflation. So, yeah, but within 85%, you know, so he didn't leave enough for managerial overhead, I guess.
See, these guys might have been remote viewers or intuitive psychics or something.
That's the only, I mean, I don't have a better explanation.
No.
The plot even includes mention of Texas politicians being annoyed because they're not involved. And in reality, that did happen, and that is why Mission Control is located in Houston.
That's a good point. Let's see if we can squeeze Kristen in from Austin, Texas. Real fast, Kristen, go ahead.
Just curious. I just came to the show about 10 minutes ago. Just got off work.
Okay.
And you were talking earlier about, you know, aliens helping ancient civilizations. And I'm kind of curious, like, if that were the case, why did they stop? Like, why haven't we received any help from them in the past years?
For some reason, if we did get alien intervention, they decided to leave. And I don't think they're still hanging around. I think they're gone, Lamont.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's a theory, certainly.
And off they go. Well, thank you so much. Lamont Wood has been our guest this hour. Out of Place and Time and Space is the name of his work. When we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM, Dr. Doom, Major Ed Dames joins us. He's a foremost remote viewer. He's an instructor as well. We're going to talk with him about some of his past and some of his present remote viewings and what he sees for the future. And we'll be back with Ed Dames on Coast to Coast AM in just a moment. If you need to email me, that's George@coasttocoastam.com.